Well, welcome today. I'm here to tell you what I've learned about AIG, but I'm hoping that there are many people in the audience today who know more than I do and will be able to share their knowledge as we go through. So today I'm talking about repercussions. When AIG was bailed out back in 2008, there was a lot of concern about what would happen to the AIG's insurance subsidiaries, and I decided to try and find out what I could about this topic. So, first thing I need to do is be able to get to the next slide. Okay, there's my email address if anyone does want to catch up with me later and give me some feedback or comments about what you know about this case. I'd be happy to hear it. Okay, so let's just go back to September 16, 2008, which was the day when the Federal Reserve Bank of New York announced that it was going to give AIG a credit facility for $85 billion. And over the next few months, the $85 million kept getting bigger and bigger until it was round about a total of $180 billion from various sources. And the U.S. government became AIG's largest shareholder, owning about 79.9% of the company. I found out later that if they went over 80%, it meant that they would have to change the way they did the accounting for the system. But according to accounting standards, if you held less than 80%, you didn't have to show certain things in the account. So, what I wanted to know was why things went wrong at AIG. And I started off being an academic without the industry gossip that you all hear, just by reading the newspapers and trying to find out the newspaper's version of what had happened. And the short story is basically AIG, the parent company, has an amazingly complicated structure with 230 different subsidiaries scattered across 130 different countries. But as a very simplified diagram of the business they were in, they had property and casualty insurers, both domestic and international, that provided about 43% of their revenue in the years up, a few years up to 2006. They had many, many life insurance companies, both domestic and international, that had about provided about 45% of their revenue in the years up to 2006. Of course, the villain of this story is the Financial Products Group, which didn't actually provide much of their income, but provided quite a substantial proportion of their losses. And they had some other lines of business as well, like aircraft leasing and asset management that provided most of the rest of the income. So today I'm mostly going to be talking about the Financial Products Group and the life insurance companies, and then I've just got a little bit at the end about the P&C insurers. So as I said before, the villain in the story, according to the newspapers, is AIG's Financial Products Group. AIG's Financial Products Group invested quite recklessly. They sold a lot of credit default swaps and other derivatives with a total face value of about $2.7 trillion. And these investments led to huge losses during 2008. So that by September 2008, they had unrealized losses exceeding $30 billion. There was a lot of argument back and forth about what the correct valuation of these securities was, but it was at least $30 billion based on their collateral calls. So as a result, they were getting collateral calls or margin calls from all their counterparties under the credit default swap contracts. And the major problem being that they didn't have enough cash to actually meet their margin calls. So there was a liquidity crisis on the horizon. Now, normally AIG would have been able to access liquidity through the commercial paper or other sources of liquidity, but at this time, of course, the entire world was falling apart. Bear Stearns had collapsed in March. IndyMac, one of the biggest banks, had gone down the drain in July. The government had taken over Fannie Mae on September 7th. Lehman Brothers was collapsing at virtually the same time ARG was going through this crisis, et cetera, et cetera. There are lots of things going wrong, and as a result, really, ARG just didn't have access to liquidity. In fact, the parent company was having to provide liquidity to some of its subsidiaries who could no longer access the commercial paper market. So ARG was facing a severe liquidity crisis. So probably most of you have heard this story before. Now, the question is, what was happening at this time to ARG's insurance subsidiaries? And if you believed the New York State Department of Insurance, there was absolutely no problem at all. They put out a press release saying, oh, the parent company, you know, they've got a few problems, but that's only because the parent company doesn't have to meet all the strict rules that insurance companies have to meet. And the AIG insurance subsidiaries are carefully regulated by highly competent, trustworthy people like us, the New York State Department of Insurance, and all the other state regulators. And we can assure you that the insurance companies are perfectly solvent and able to pay all of their obligations. Do not go out and surrender your policies. And they said the regulators make sure that the assets of the insurance companies are walled off and protected from the parent company's troubles and therefore available to pay all the policyholder claims. So over the years, sadly, I've become a more cynical person than I used to be when I was young. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. All walled off. No problems there at all. And I thought, somebody told me that Larry Adler was well known for saying that insurance company regulations provide great big walls around insurance companies, but if you look carefully, there's usually a small unlocked door somewhere around the corner that allows you to do what you want if you work out how to do it. So historically, I'm afraid, even though theoretically subsidiaries are walled off, there are often ways to get around these regulatory walls and obtain access to the insurance company's assets. And if you look at the academic literature, there's a lot of studies showing that one of the main causes of insolvency for life insurance companies is getting entangled in the losses of the parent company or other subsidiaries. So let's see what really happened at AIG. Were the insurance subsidiaries as safe as they seem to be? The summary of what I'm going to say about what really happened is the newspapers were right about AIG financial products. In the end, they lost about $50 billion as a result of their credit default swaps and other derivatives. But the newspapers weren't really right about the life insurance subsidiaries. Despite what the state regulators told everyone, the life insurance subsidiaries were not in great shape. They weren't really that well regulated. They were not effectively walled off from the parent. And in fact, they lost about $42 billion on their own account as well in 2008. So just to put that in perspective, AIG's total capital at the start of 2008 was about $100 billion. They lost $50 billion from financial products and $42 billion from the life insurance company. So you can see things were not looking good overall. So to find out what really happens, being an academic, I go and read government reports, and I would have to say there are several thousand pages of government reports about AIG. As usual, all the congressional committees hold hearings where they interrogate people and try and work out who should be blamed, usually a member of the other party, whichever party is not being interrogated. Those hearings are quite entertaining, but sometimes not very helpful. The really good stuff is in the GAO reports, the Government Accountability Office. Once the government became the owners of AIG, that meant that they wanted to keep track of AIG and see how they were going and whether they were going to make enough money to pay back the loans. So every few months, the Government Accountability Office would do a report on the financial status of everything that the government had invested some money in, including the insurance companies. There's also a Congressional Oversight Panel, which was chaired by Elizabeth Warren, the bane of Wall Street, I think. She's a very determined person who is highly critical of the financial system, former Harvard professor. And they did a really excellent summary of the... It's like 300 pages long, but it's a really excellent summary of what went wrong. And, of course, the Financial Crisis Inquiry also produced some reports about AIG. And what I like about the Financial Crisis Inquiry is they managed to get their hands on all the internal documents and emails going back and forth between people. So you can see that it's often quite interesting to see a press release coming out saying everything is perfectly fine, whereas the emails that you look at later say, oh, you know, we're completely stuffed here. we're going to be working all weekend, and does anyone have any ideas what we can do about this? So I always enjoy reading the actual internal documents from the period, and they've got them all on their website, so that's quite interesting. So one of the questions that they wanted to look at was, where did all the money go? The government chipped in $85 billion. I think AIG spent $61 billion in the first 2 weeks. But this is a graph showing where the money went. So in just the 2008 money. So as you can see in this graph, $47 billion went to the financial products group to meet their margin calls and other debts. But the second biggest category here is about $21 billion. And that was money that was used as capital contributions to the life insurance companies. Another $1.5 billion was money that the parent company paid to the life insurance subsidiaries to repay a line of credit. They'd already borrowed $1.5 billion. $3.2 billion was related to payments from the parent company to subsidiaries in relation to the securities lending program, which I'm going to describe in a few minutes. So the problem here is the New York State Department of Insurance had been putting out press releases saying the insurance subsidiaries are AIG's bars of gold, they're solvent companies, they're profitable, this is where we're going to get the money to repay the government that $81 billion. But you have to ask, if AIG's life insurance subsidiaries were in such great shape, why did they need $25 billion in extra capital from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York? Makes you think maybe they did have a few problems there at the life insurance company if they needed $25 billion. So this is where the other part of the problem comes from, and this is AIG's securities lending program. So the little red boxes represent 12 of AIG's life insurance companies. They all put securities into a pool, this middle circle here, AIG's securities lending program. And this was run by a separate subsidiary of AIG and managed by another subsidiary. And what would happen is they'd just lend their securities to securities borrowers, usually investment banks and hedge funds, that wanted to just have a short-term loan of some securities, often for short selling. The securities borrowers would then give collateral back to the AIG securities lending pool, which would take that money, which was collateral for the securities borrowers, and invest it to earn a little bit of extra cash. Now, that's a pretty commonplace arrangement. Lots of insurance companies have this kind of setup just to make some extra money. Didn't really cause any problems for quite a while until 2005. Previously, collateral had been invested very conservatively in liquid short-term assets. But in 2005, someone in the securities lending group decided it would be a really good time to invest in residential mortgage-backed securities. Turned out not to be a good idea. By the end of 2007, while everyone else in the entire financial system was desperately trying to dump their residential mortgage-backed securities, AIG Securities Lending Program was boosting its investment. So they had about $76 billion in the securities lending business, and about 60% was in residential mortgage-backed securities, which many of them were AAA rated at the time but didn't stay AAA rated for much longer. That amounts to roughly 10% of the total life insurance company assets for the domestic companies. So 10% of their money was now in this securities lending program. Now, 2006-2007 was definitely not a good time to be getting into residential mortgage-backed securities. And in fact, AIG's own financial products group had already made a decision towards the end of 2005 that this line of business was way too risky. And in fact, one branch of AIG's business, the financial products group, was trying to cut its exposure to residential mortgage-backed securities at the same time the securities lending program was trying to increase its exposure. So not good risk management strategy there. In fact, they don't seem to have known what each other was doing. So at the beginning of 2008, the total capital of the domestic life insurers was $20 billion. They were in good shape at the time because their risk-based capital requirement was only $3 billion, so they had about six times what they needed just to meet risk-based capital requirements. But by the end of the year, they'd lost $22 billion in the securities lending program. So now you're beginning to see why they needed a bit of a capital boost from the bailout package. The other big problem with the securities lending program was that it created a huge extra liquidity risk for AIG because the securities lending counterparties could return the securities virtually at any time or at very short notice and ask for their collateral back. Now, the problem was that by this time, most of their collateral was invested in residential mortgage-backed securities, which were by this stage getting to be pretty illiquid. They did about, I think, 16% of the securities lending program was kept in liquid assets, but that wasn't really enough when the crisis hit. The securities lending program was managed by AIG Global Investment Management, another subsidiary of AIG. And apparently, now I find this really hard to believe, but one of the books that I read about this, Fatal Risk, said that they did not even tell the life insurance companies what they were doing with the investments. They didn't tell them that they decided to switch from conservative liquid investments into residential mortgage-backed securities. They simply changed the line in the prospectus to give themselves greater flexibility in the management of the pool, and there are suggestions in some of the readings that they even deceived the life insurance companies about how they had the money invested. They also didn't really think it was necessary to tell the state regulators about the change to the asset allocation. So all of this was off balance sheet and not transparent to the regulators. Now, the regulators did eventually notice what was going on, but it took a while to figure it out. They became rather alarmed by mid-2007, which was really when there was beginning to be quite a lot of concern about subprime mortgages. They told AIG they had to reduce the portfolio, but of course by that time it was difficult to sell. And they also made the parent company put in a $5 billion guarantee to the subsidiary. So now the subsidiaries now have up their financial status dependent on AIG being able to fulfill that guarantee later on. When you read the testimony later by the regulators, they very proudly explained that they had been successful in persuading AIG to reduce their portfolio from $76 billion down to $58 billion, which was a drop of $18 billion. And they're patting themselves on the back saying what good regulators we were. But I read about it later and I thought, well, actually, the losses on the market and the market value of the portfolio were $16 billion during this period, so I'm not sure if they should really get credit for the reduction in the total. I mean, I could be wrong about this, but it just looks to me like AIG wasn't really selling things down. The portfolio was getting smaller because they were just losing money really fast. So what happens? What was interesting about this was the interactions between the different subsidiaries, between financial products and securities lending, because the securities lending operations started announcing their losses in quarterly reports throughout 2007 and 2008. And the result of this was that eventually the ratings companies noticed and they downgraded AIG partly because of those losses. Now, that had a bad effect because the amount of the margin calls at Financial Products Group depended on the credit rating of AIG. So when AIG had a credit rating downgrade, the Financial Products Group had to pay even more money in margin calls, which they couldn't afford to do. And that meant that they were facing bigger liquidity problems because of the problems in the securities lending group. And those liquidity problems led to another credit rating downgrade. And then the securities borrowers said, gee, we don't want to have our collateral invested with a company that's got a really bad credit rating. Can we have all our securities back? And then there were liquidity problems for the securities lending companies. You can see it was sort of a vicious cycle there. And, of course, the counterparties on the securities borrowing program were also the counterparties of AIGFP. So the counterparties had a pretty good idea of the picture from both sides, probably in some cases a better idea than AIG's management had, I would suspect. So what happened was on 15th of September, three credit rating agencies downgraded AIG. The bailout was announced the next day. Over the next 2 weeks, the securities lending counterparties demanded a return of $24 billion in cash collateral. They returned the securities and said, we'd like our money back, please. Unfortunately, of course, all the money in the securities lending program was invested in highly illiquid assets. So that just made things were bad already, but this didn't really help. So in October 2008, the government stepped in with an emergency stopgap scheme where basically the Federal Reserve Bank said, okay, we'll become the counterparty for the securities lending program. They actually became the securities borrowers, effectively, for $17 billion. And that provided some cash collateral to help the liquidity problems in the securities lending pool. Eventually, about a month later, the Federal Reserve Bank set up this organization called Maiden Lane II, which just effectively bought out all of the assets, or virtually all of the assets, in the securities lending pool. They paid just over $20 billion to buy assets with a face value of $39 billion, so that really crystallized the life insurance company's losses. Seemed like a good idea at the time because it reduced their risk-based capital requirements for the life insurance companies. By this time, they were having capital issues, so they needed to get their risk levels down. This was one way of doing it. Okay, so this is where I'm going to ask what you guys think. When a parent company is in trouble, should its insurance subsidiaries provide support to the parent company? And if so, under what circumstances and who should decide? So I'm just going to look at the crisis weekend, which was started on Friday, September 12th. Basically, AIG knew it was in trouble. It was expecting to get a credit rating downgrade on the Monday, which meant that they would need an extra $20 billion in collateral for AIGFP. So where would they get the money? So they looked around and thought, well, we have all these subsidiaries. They've got a lot of money. So the first thing they did was draw down $1 billion from the life insurance companies under a line of credit. On September 15th, the Monday, the regulator said, you must stop that. We don't want you taking any more money out of our insurance companies. This is where the wall comes in, right? The wall around the insurance company assets. And in fact, a few days later, they said, not only aren't you allowed to borrow any more money, you have to give back what you've previously borrowed. Okay. Now, that was the story that I read in several documents where the regulator was saying, we took action to protect the assets. Now I'll tell you what really happened. This is in a very small footnote on about page 87 of one of the government Accountability Office reports. They borrowed $1 billion on the Friday. The regulator said, wait a second, don't borrow any more money. On September 16th, AIG said to the regulators, if you don't give us some more money right now, we're going to default. And the regulator said, okay, you can have $5 billion more out of the insurance companies. Funny how that didn't get into most of the reports later. By that night, the bailout had been announced and AIG said, thanks anyway, we don't need the $5 billion, you can have it back. And then they said, you have to return all the money later. So the question is, was this a good decision by the insurance regulator? Now, you could probably say the regulator was under a lot of pressure to agree to this, and he probably knew that there was a very high probability that the bailout was going to go ahead. Still, I'm not sure if that wall is beginning to actually seem to have a few little chinks here and there where money could possibly leak out from the insurance companies. Next thing that happened on that same weekend was the rescue plan. The bunch of people were sitting around in the Federal Reserve Bank offices saying, these guys need some money. AIG said, well, we've got all these property casualty companies. They've got a big surplus, way more than the regulatory minimum. They have a lot of liquid assets. Couldn't they kind of help us out a bit? So they proposed an asset swap. They said the property casualty companies will buy shares in AIG's life insurance company. So they'd go to the parent company owned the shares in the life insurance company. The property casualty companies would become part owners of the life insurance companies and in return would provide liquid assets to AIG of $20 billion. The plan was announced in a press release by the governor of New York on September 15th. It was a very, let's pat ourselves on the back, we're saving AIG type of press release. Aren't we wonderful? We're rescuing this company. My question is, why is the governor of New York the one that is apparently making this decision about what's going to happen to the insurance company assets of the property casualty companies? I don't understand the American political system, but anyway. So the question I want to ask, if it was you and you were the insurance regulator, would you have agreed to this plan or not?
That's not a rhetorical question.
It's not a rhetorical question. It's not a rhetorical question. What would you? Was it a fair enough thing to do?
Is it
not? Well, I thought about it. And I thought, well, my first question was, did the PNC insurance companies really have a lot of excess capital? But that's just my basic cynicism about insurance company accounts, especially AIGs. They'd already had a few little issues in that area. And in fact, they did have quite substantial adverse development and had to increase their reserves by several billion dollars over the next couple of years. Second question is, when you're thinking about this situation, the parent company's about to go down the drain. It seems likely that the subsidiaries would also be having some troubles fairly soon as if the parent company collapsed. And maybe they would actually kind of need that extra capital to help them out during the impending catastrophe that was coming soon and predictably coming soon. And the third thing is, if you were a property casualty company, would you really want to be a part owner of a bunch of life insurance companies that were facing solvency problems and needed a capital influx? I thought about this and I thought, probably not.
Sean, though, can I ask if the PNC companies were subs of the parent company, can't they just extract that excess capital?
They could only extract the excess capital if the state regulator gave them permission to do so.
Right.
There was a wall. And in fact, New York State Insurance Department said they would not go ahead with this plan unless the policyholder interests were protected. They had the right to veto it. The plan was never implemented because by the end of the weekend they knew that $20 billion was not nearly enough to save AIG, so that rescue plan kind of fell through. I read a paper by someone who was very critical of this decision. This is a quote from his paper. In giving his buddies at AIG a helping hand, Dinalo, that was the insurance commissioner, showed just how rapidly and completely a state insurance regulator can fold when the chips are down. This was a failure of insurance regulation on a monumental scale. Not only did the security guards fail to keep the bank robbers locked out, they unlocked the vault and helped load the truck. I don't don't know. So, you know, I see there's arguments on both sides. If you are interested, I'll put a reference into this article, which actually has both the insurance commissioner defending his decision and a few other people attacking his decision. So I guess they had to make a decision in a very short time. The next question I wanted to ask is, what would have happened to AIG's insurance subsidiaries if AIG had not been rescued? Would the failure of the parent inevitably have led to the failure of the subsidiaries? So, as usual, I don't want to make you incredibly cynical, but I can't help it. In the testimony afterwards, all the insurance regulators said, no problem, we looked after the insurance companies. The government didn't need to rescue AIG because of the insurance companies, because they were perfectly solvent. There were no problems. The dependable moat of state regulation that protects policyholders remained solid. Solid moat, well, never mind. On the other hand, when the people from the Fed and the Treasury had to testify, they took completely the opposite point of view and said doomsday would have happened. If AIG had not been rescued, it would have been a complete disaster for all of AIG's insurance companies, for the entire insurance industry, and for every single ordinary American who depends on these insurance companies. And they listed all the bad things that would happen. The regulators would seize the company. There would be a run on the policyholders' funds. That would cause liquidity problems. They listed all the bad things that were going to happen. Now, the unfortunate Congressional Oversight Panel had to try and compare these two points of view and decide who was right. And their perspective on it was that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury were actually, in fact, exaggerating the risks to the insurance companies, because by the time the hearings were being held, there was a lot of public anger at the bailout of AIG, and people felt that the government had only bailed out AIG because it was good for Goldman Sachs and the other merchant banks. And they were doing a bit of PR here, because apparently widows and orphans and retirees are much more sympathetic and popular than Goldman Sachs. So if they reframed the rescue package as being a rescue for the American policyholders, that would be more palatable politically than saying we had to do it because our friends at Goldman Sachs really needed the money. So the Congressional Oversight Panel was a bit critical of this, but they said there was really no way to tell what would have happened to the subsidiaries because it depended on so many different factors. First one, how would the state insurance regulators have reacted? Would they have immediately seized all the companies to protect them? Second, how intertwined were all these different companies with each other and with the parent company? To what extent were there linkages that would make a systemic risk? How strong were, in fact, the life insurance companies? If they were really weak, obviously there were more risks. What was going to happen to the credit ratings? Because that would have a big impact on their future line of business. And how would the policyholders react? So, and I'm probably running out of time here. First question was, would the state regulators seize the insurance companies? And if you were the regulator, the parent company had just gone broke, you had a life insurance company that was having a few little capital issues, would you seize the company? Or would you say, well, it's probably going to recover, we'll just let things go on for a while?
Do you have the power to seize the company?
The state regulators, every state has different legislation, of course, in the United States. They all have, most of them would have had power to do something, but it's different powers in every state. And it would depend also on the solvency of the company. Yeah. But they generally, a lot of them do have quite broad powers. So they asked the regulators, what would you have done? And they said, we would have done whatever was necessary to protect our policyholders. Some of them said, yes, we would have seized the companies. Other ones said, no, we would have waited to see. But I should point out, I've read a lot of these case studies. Historically, all the state regulators do not have a good record of cooperation during a crisis because they're all either elected or appointed. It's very political. And basically, each state regulator wants to protect his own constituency. And if there's going to be not enough assets and too many people who want them, There's a tendency for each state regulator to grab as much control of its assets on behalf of its own policyholders as they can. So it gets to be a bit of a bun fight. So basically, as soon as one regulator seized a company, all the other ones would also rush in to seize companies because they wouldn't want their assets to be siphoned off to another state. And this was especially true if the companies had a lot of cross-shareholding and guarantees. I should mention that in September 2008, while the bailout negotiations were going on, the Texas Department of Insurance had already drawn up the legal papers to take over the four insurance companies that were under their control in the state of Texas. So I think there would have been quite a likely tendency that there would have been some seizures. Another problem being the AIG companies were all really tightly intertwined. They had a lot of intercompany transactions, cross holdings of shares. They held common stock in each other's subsidiaries. And if they held stock in the non-insurance subsidiaries, which would now be the subject of bankruptcy proceedings because they were not covered by the state insurance regulations, then some of their capital would just disappear when those shares became valueless. That stock was part, the shares in the other companies was part of their regulatory capital. And some subsidiaries had provided guarantees for smaller subsidiaries. And in fact, the parent company had also provided guarantees for a lot of the insurance companies. So this is, if you were going to write a little textbook on how would you create systemic risk, this would be a good starting point. Were the life insurance companies actually solvent? I think I've really covered this before. The state regulators were repeatedly claiming that the AIG life insurance companies were solvent. But the Government Accounting Office and the Congressional Oversight Panel, both in their reports, claimed that the life insurance companies would not have been able to meet minimum capital requirements without the government assistance that was provided to AIG. So the government assistance provided to AIG was funneled down to the insurance companies. As I said before, $25 billion of the bailout money was used to recapitalize the insurance companies. There is a paper written by an actuary in the United States called that says, to what degree were AIG's operating subsidiaries sound? I found it slightly horrifying to read, but because it explains exactly how an insurance company can look sound while not actually being sound and all the different tricks you can use to make yourself look more solvent than you really are. And it also outlines exactly how much money each insurance company lost in the securities lending program. Some of them lost, the amount of money they lost in the securities lending program was more than twice their capital. More than twice. He wrote down the amount of capital they had at the start of the year and the amount of money that they lost in the securities lending program, and in some cases the ratio was 200%. So, anyway, interesting article. What would happen to the life insurance company's credit ratings? All three major credit rating agencies downgraded the parent company on September 15th, and at the same time they downgraded the subsidiaries as well. When they were asked why they did that, they said basically, as soon as the subsidiary goes down the drain, automatically that will, well, not automatically, but it's very likely it will lead to a downgrade of the subsidiaries because the parent company is no longer there to provide support when they need recapitalization, and they're going to suffer a lot of reputational risk, which will damage their business. So as a result of credit rating losses, of course, that meant that it was much more likely that there'd be a run. The rating agencies were asked to state what they thought would be the impact of further downgradings after this date. S&P said new domestic business for the life insurance companies would be severely affected, forcing the company to exit business lines that serve high-net-worth individuals or businesses governed by trust contracts. For the general insurers, AM Best said that if there was one more ratings downgrade, they'd lose about 50% of their net premium. Now, the government was well aware of this, which is why over the next few months, as the companies struggled, the government progressively made the bailout conditions more lenient so that the credit rating agencies would not downgrade the insurance companies any further. Okay. Policyholder reaction, the State Insurance Commissioner said, everything's fine, don't worry about it, don't take your money out, don't believe all those other agents who are telling you that you should switch your money to another company. But policyholders, this shows the withdrawal surrender rates. This is when the bailout happened. You can see that a lot of insurance policyholders did not pay much attention to the state regulators, and they took their money out regardless. Though they did recover later. Maybe all the ones who'd already withdrawn had wanted to withdraw had already withdrawn by that time, and that's why the withdrawal rates were lower later. This is the new business income. As you can see, they didn't sell much new business in the fourth quarter of 2008. SunAmerica said they lost between $2 and $3 billion in sales between September 2008 and March 2009. Now, this is just an issue I wanted to raise. The government did not want to own an insurance company. They were a reluctant shareholder. And as part of the bailout, AIG started selling off many of its companies in order to pay back the government. But it was difficult to find buyers in such a depressed market. And from my past studies of insurance company failures, this is a high-risk situation for policyholders. You've got a desperate seller. Usually, when insurance company liabilities are transferred from one company to another, there are a lot of prudential controls to make sure that the buying company is financially sound and a fit and proper company. But when the seller is really, really keen to sell, sometimes these standards are relaxed, which means that there may be a temptation to let people buy companies when it's not really in the best interest of the policyholders. In other words, you can sell your policyholders down the river if you're desperate enough for money. Now, I have no idea at all if that happened with AIG, but I just think it's a risk that is identified. If the government is the one that has to approve the sale, and the government is also the one who's going to financially benefit from the sale, that seems to me like a built-in conflict of interest. For the P&C subsidiaries, they lost a lot of business. Premium income declined rapidly, much more rapidly than the rest of the industry. One of the issues that came up was that all the AIG's competitors complained bitterly to their congressman that AIG was underpricing in order to retain market share, and they were charging premiums that were much too low relative to the risk. Basically, they were selling at a loss, and they were taking advantage of the fact that they had an implicit government guarantee. The government assigned the GAO to investigate in 2009, and the GAO threw up its hand and said, well, we really can't tell. AIG, even before the crisis, AIG was often the lowest in the market, most competitive. It's too difficult to make comparisons in the commercial property casualty market. The reasonableness of premiums is just a matter of the actuary's opinion. It's totally subjective. It's long-tail business. We won't be able to tell for several years whether it was profitable or not, so really we can't tell. This is a picture of the loss ratios for AIG. The black line shows the AIG's loss ratios for their property casualty companies. The red line shows the loss ratios for 15 other peer companies, large companies in similar lines of business. And as you can see, AIG's loss ratios were consistently higher and during 2008, 2009, quite substantially higher than their competitors. And in fact, sometimes above 100%. They had to write up their loss reserves in fourth quarter 2009 and again in fourth quarter 2010. So their loss ratio was 165% in that year. So this is the combined ratio. Again, higher than their peers throughout this period, except for one little blip there. So I'm not a general insurance actuary. Those of you in the audience who are could perhaps tell me, would this indicate that AIG was underpricing or selling at non-competitive rates? They were making a profit in many periods. So again, this is a conflict of interest because basically you have the government supervising a government-owned insurance company. The Government Accountability Office had to decide if AIG was behaving improperly, the P&C subsidiaries, But those PNC subsidiaries were owned by the government, which had every interest in making sure that they did keep their market share so they could sell them for a lot of money and or get profits back to repay their loans. So there are some difficulties here in letting a government take over an insurance company, which is then regulated by the government. I just think that's a bit of an issue. So questions to discuss, and I know we're probably out of time. Is it possible to evaluate the risks facing an insurance company subsidiary without knowing what's happening in the parent company? What rules should apply to transactions between affiliates, seeing it causes so much trouble? Was it appropriate to call upon AIG's insurance subsidiaries to provide support for the parent company? And if the answer is, well, maybe it depends on the circumstances, who gets to decide? The governor of New York? I really don't know what his qualifications were. AIG's insurers clearly suffered reputational damage leading to a loss of business and liquidity problems. Is it possible to actually measure and manage reputational risk? And if so, how could this be done? So, do we have any time left at all, or do we all have to go? Perfect timing, sorry. But maybe over coffee you can talk about some of these issues.
Well, thank you very much, Shauna.